You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. It's not every day that you hear a former Secretary of Defense and a veteran of four presidents' national security councils say that the U.S. military is too powerful. But that's exactly the stance that Robert Gates took during his time as Secretary of Defense to Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. And now, in a new book called Exercise of Power, American Failures, Successes, and a New Path Forward in the Post-Cold War World, Gates continues to make his case that America overuses and often misuses the military to achieve our strategic goals while neglecting more practical non-military options at our disposal. And today, Robert Gates joins me on the podcast to discuss how Congress and the last five presidents have allowed many of those non-military instruments of power that served us so well during the Cold War to wither and die over the past three decades. He suggests that presidents need to be less monastic and more Madison Avenue in how we talk about the good that America does around the world, that presidents need to take time to better explain their goals to the media, and to convince the American people to take a broader, more long-term view of the U.S. national interest, because as he points out, America's allies are her greatest resource against adversaries like Russia and China. Robert Gates criticizes President Trump's threat to use regular military forces to squelch Black Lives Matter protests and explains that a heavy-handed approach to peaceful protesters may be a gift to authoritarian regimes around the world. Plus, he says it may be time for the U.S. to focus on more realistic goals with North Korea. He elaborates on the sometimes mischievous nature of the National Security Council and weighs in on whether he buys the president's claim that his former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, is a traitor and a liar. Coming up with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in just a moment. Robert M. Gates served as Secretary of Defense under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He was an officer in the United States Air Force and worked for the CIA before being appointed director of that agency. A member of the National Security Council staff in four administrations, he served eight presidents of both political parties. He's also the author of the best-selling books Duty and A Passion for Leadership, and now he's out with his latest book, Exercise of Power, American Failures, Successes, and a New Path Forward in the Post-Cold War World. Dr. Gates, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, Dr. Gates, I really enjoyed Exercise of Power, and I guess the thesis of your book is that presidents need to use the full range of American power, not just the military. Now, some may find that a surprising position coming from a former Secretary of Defense, but as I recall, you were criticizing America's overuse of the military even while you were Secretary of Defense.
That's right. Actually, I gave a speech at Kansas State University in the fall of 2007. I'd been in the job less than a year, and I gave a speech arguing that there ought to be more resources allocated for the State Department. And I think the news media sort of treated it as a man bites dog story that they'd never heard of a Secretary of Defense that arguing for more money for the State Department.
Yeah, that's extremely unusual. When did this first begin to dawn on you, this idea that we're overusing the military?
I think as I watched what had happened in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and the challenges that we were having in both countries after the initial military victories, and the consequences of the non-military resources available to the government having real impact. One of the significant civilian efforts, if you will, in both Iraq and Afghanistan, as part of the nation building, were called Provincial Reconstruction Teams, PRTs. Mm-hmm. And they operated throughout both countries. And at the height of our troop presence in Iraq, we had 170,000 troops. But in all of the PRTs in all of Iraq, we had 360 civilians. So that suggests the disparity between the resources available for the military and those available, if you will, for the follow-up to the military success.
And you actually argue in your book that the U.S. should have withdrawn from Afghanistan in January 2002. Why do you pick that specific window? What changed after that?
By January of 2002, we not only had military success in Afghanistan in expelling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, the Afghans had come together, representative of some two dozen different political entities and tribes and factions in Afghanistan had come together, had jointly agreed on an interim government and who should lead it, and a process moving toward a constitution and regular elections. They had recognition from all of the surrounding countries, including Iran and Pakistan and India and Russia and us and so on. And a program was put together in Germany at a conference in Bonn, Germany. So by January 2nd, you had an interim government that had been chosen by the Afghans themselves. And it was the Northern Alliance. It was the Pashtuns. It was all the major different elements in Afghanistan coming together. You had a leader who had legitimacy. You had international recognition. The Japanese had sponsored a conference in which people had pledged assistance money to help Afghanistan rebuild and develop. So at that moment, we really had achieved all, it seemed to me, all of the objectives we realistically could have hoped for. And that was a moment when we could extract ourselves because of the international recognition and the internal agreement in terms of how to go forward. Mm-hmm. And it was only when we decided really the importance of staying in Afghanistan to try and on our own bring them into the 20th century that we got into trouble and ended up with a war that has now gone on 19 years.
Right. And that's something that you ponder at length in Exercise of Power, this noble ideal of America as a beacon of freedom and our responsibility to support aspiring democracies around the world, but also the problems that arise when the U.S. tries to impose democracy from the end of a gun. Now, to go back to the thesis of your book, that America relies too heavily on the military and not enough on these other tools such as diplomacy, economic assistance, strategic communication, etc., you say that this is a question that you began considering way back in 1993, back when the U.S. was on top of the world after the fall of the Soviet Union. To show just how much has changed, contrast the U.S.'s role in the world in 1993 versus what you see today.
Well, at the end of the Cold War and with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States was such a dominant power in every aspect of power, not just military, but economic, political, cultural. I mean, we really sort of dominated the world, and there was no rival to us at all. And it was a unique moment in history. I think maybe, if not unique, only one precedent for a country with equal geographic reach, and that would have been the Roman Empire. And also the same cultural influence and economic influence and so on. So we stood at a unique moment in history, at least in modern history. By 2000, well, by today, we're beset by challenges at every turn. We are still the most powerful country in the world economically and militarily, but politically and in other areas of power, we are beset by a variety of challenges that that frankly we have not had much success in dealing with.
And it's worth noting that during the Cold War, the U.S. and Soviet military powers were more or less at parity. They offset each other. So a lot of the competition that took place in these kind of non-military realms that you talk about in your book, like economics, strategic communications, culture, et cetera. What happened to all those?
Unfortunately, at the end of the Cold War, there wasn't much support for sustaining them. And I mean, the powers that we're talking about are in the economic arena, development assistance, loans, discounted loans to other countries, trade concessions, sanctions, and so on. Strategic communications, the use of our science and technology and our advantages in that arena, our use of our ideology, the use of intelligence in terms of informing our allies and covert action to try and make things happen that presidents wanted to happen. And almost all of those were dismantled in the 1990s, and some of them at the instigation of the Congress. The United States Information Agency, which at its high point was a strategic communications giant in terms of reaching the entire world with America's message and what we wanted to communicate about us and about what was going on in the world. And in its heyday under President Kennedy with Edward R. Murrow, and under President Reagan with Charlie Wick, it just had enormous reach, and it was abolished in 1998 by the Congress. And the United States Information Agency, the Congress also wanted to abolish it. Clinton didn't do that, but he did tucked it under the State Department, diminishing its role. The State Department diplomacy is a hugely important non-military instrument of power. And the State Department was starved of resources for the next quarter of a century, with a couple of brief exceptions during the George W. Bush administration. I always used to make the point, well, actually, Secretary of State Condi Rice would point out to me from time to time that I had more people in military bands than she had in the entire Foreign Service. So, you know, all of these instruments were dismantled mainly during the 1990s. And it was sort of like after the Cold War, nobody saw any need for any of this anymore. I think the idea set in, at least subconsciously, with people that our dominance, unilateral dominance, would somehow continue interminably. And anybody who's read history knows that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
That there are other challengers will arise, and especially when one power is so dominant. Mm-hmm. And so we basically deprived ourselves of all of these things. And the problem with it was that, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And so if the only robust instrument of power that you have is the military, then you're going to use the military to accomplish your objectives. And trying to get the military, so nation building was ambitious, unrealistically ambitious in its own right, but trying to use the military to accomplish it really was a mistake, I think.
And I have to say, it would seem that President Trump is pretty much doing the opposite of what you're suggesting in your book. Not only is he allowing these non-military instruments to wither, but he wants to expand the use of the American military into domestic realms that traditionally haven't fallen under the military's purview, such as sending troops to the border or threatening to use military force to squelch protests. You've served under 8 presidents. In all of your years of service, have you ever seen a president with this much enthusiasm for using military within our borders?
Well, first of all, I think it's worth noting that that the administration, both in 2017 and 2018, and really since becoming into office, mm-hmm. has tried dramatically to further cut back these non-military instruments, like the State Department and foreign assistance and so on. They initially proposed a 30% cut in the size of the State Department. And the only way that was avoided was the Congress pushed back and refused to accept those cuts. They didn't increase the budget, but they at least prevented these drastic further cuts from taking place. I think the picture in terms of the president's use of the military at home is a little more mixed. I mean, one of the things that I resented a lot when I was secretary was that we had several thousand National Guard troops that had been deployed along the border. In my view, it was a political thing by the governors of those states, so they could tell their populations, I've got this immigration thing under control, I'm taking very strong measures, blah, blah, blah. Now, the reason that they were federalized is that when they're federalized, the federal government has to pay for it. They could have mobilized those National Guard troops under their own authority as governors. But then that would have meant that the states of Texas and Arizona and New Mexico would have had to pay the bill mm-hmm. rather than the federal government. So that's why they got federalized. I think taking money out of the defense budget for the wall was a mistake. I mean, when I look at the military construction projects that were sacrificed in order to pay for that transfer, I think was a mistake. I'm not objecting to the wall necessarily. I'm just saying the Defense Department shouldn't be asked to pay for it.
Right.
There was a lot of debate, particularly around the question of whether to call up regular troops to deal with the situation in Lafayette Square in Washington a couple of weeks ago. And I think in some ways that was a useful experience because I think it had two lessons. One was that it was those events around Lafayette Square served as a stark reminder of the importance of the military remaining politically or remaining apolitical. Mm-hmm. That the military doesn't work for one president or one party, but it works for the American people as a whole. And I think the pushback from some former senior military officers, General Mattis, Admiral Mullen, General Dempsey, the latter two, both former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, against the use of regular troops and the use of the Insurrection Act, which authorizes the president to use regular troops domestically, was a useful reminder of the importance of the military being apolitical. But I think also, you know, every president I worked for loved to use the military as a political prop.
Sure.
There's just nothing like having a bunch of soldiers or generals behind you to suggest that, you know, you're a really powerful guy. And I think this president's taken this to a whole new level. But I think that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, and the Secretary of Defense actually didn't know that they were going to be used in a political or in a photo op, the photo op at the church. And once Milley realized what was going on, he sort of disappeared into the crowd and managed to avoid the photo op, but it evoked a lot of criticism that he was there in the first place, and he apologized for that. And it was an important reminder for the senior military of not letting themselves be exploited in a way that appears political. So it reinforced the point about not using regular troops and about the military being apolitical. And I think both Esper and Milley have sent messages through the whole chain of command, sort of reminding people at every level of the importance of the military remaining apolitical. And I think in that respect, there was some value that came out of that lamentable episode, simply in sort of reinforcing what had been a long-held tenet. And yeah. And also, I think, stiffening the resistance in the Department of Defense not to be used or exploited in that way again. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. When the president uses force on peaceful protesters in Lafayette Square or threatens to use regular military forces against protesters around the country, doesn't that undermine America's moral authority and invite Russia and China to weaponize those controversies to justify their own authoritarian abuses?
Well, and really doesn't even need to be limited to the military. There's no question but that the Russians and the Chinese are using these demonstrations and the use of force against them by law enforcement or whoever is involved, whether it's law enforcement or the National Guard, to basically argue, well, how can you possibly criticize us for suppressing the demonstrators in Hong Kong when you do this yourselves all over America? And the same kind of message from the Russians, that you can't lecture us about political freedom and about human rights and political rights when you're repressing demonstrators in your own country. So there's no question that the demonstrations and the way the protests have been put down in some places have been a propaganda windfall for both the Russians and the Chinese.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Of these non-military instruments that you talk about in your book, you place particular importance on strategic communications. And you suggest that we need to be, as you say it, less monastic and more Madison Avenue. What do you mean by that?
Well, we do a lot of really good things around the world, and with some recipients being pretty surprising, and nobody knows about them. Our humanitarian assistance puts every other country in the world to shame in terms of what we do. And a couple of examples that I give in the book, nobody in the world, I think, knows that during the North Korean famine in 1998 and 1999, the United States gave more food assistance to North Korea, our decades-long enemy, than all the rest of the world put together. And wow. Three times what the Chinese gave them. Very few people know that the Bush administration, second Bush administration in 2004, sent humanitarian assistance to Iran after an earthquake in northern Iran. Right. You had multiple American military cargo aircraft delivering medical supplies and more to the town of Bam that had been hit by this earthquake. The Iranians obviously didn't want anybody to know that we had delivered that assistance. They wanted the assistance. And why we bowed to the Iranians and didn't trumpet all over the world that we were giving assistance to the Iranians just puzzles me. It's the same thing with North Korea. And to this day, people don't realize that the United States, everybody talks about how we've stayed out of the Syrian civil war. And I think that's probably been a good decision on the part of both presidents. Obama and President Trump, but nobody talks about the fact that we've given more than $9 billion in assistance for refugees in Syria, inside Syria and out in countries outside of Syria. So, and same thing is true in Somalia. We're still giving, we're still a major donor for Somalia. Why no one knows about this is very strange to me, that we don't trumpet these things that we do that no one else is able to do and or does. Mm-hmm. And the contrast with the Chinese is especially stark. They don't do anything and they don't give anything away. When they were offering medical equipment in association with the coronavirus, most countries, they were charging for that assistance that they provided. So And when there are other natural disasters around the world, the Chinese are nowhere to be seen.
Right. There is a little bit of a bright side here in that you point out that America has a huge advantage over China and Russia in that we have allies. They don't. They have clients or marriages of convenience at best. But is there any doubt in your mind that right now many of those important relationships have been jeopardized?
Yeah, I think that there's no question that that the administration and the president really don't understand the value and the importance of allies, and more importantly, that it's a unique asset for the United States, as you were just quoting. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese have no allies. And the example that I use, let's just take our economic problems with China. Well, most other countries have economic problems with China too. And we argue that the Chinese need to make structural changes. They need to stop stealing technology. They need to allow foreign investment in across the board. And they just need to change the way they approach these things. But just think how much more powerful our bargaining position would be if on our side of the table, we also had the Europeans, the Japanese, the Australians, the Indians, and so on, all of whom could say, if you know, using the same talking point, if you don't fix these structural imbalances and level the playing field, there will be economic consequences for you that you will not like. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, nobody pushed our allies harder to spend more on defense than I did. And I warned them as I was leaving in 2011, that I was probably the last senior national security official in the United States they would ever encounter who had an emotional attachment to NATO, because I was there for their role in the Cold War and in taking on the Soviet Union. I said, a new generation of politicians is going to come to power in Congress and in the White House, and they're going to look at this as a cost-benefit analysis, and you're going to come up short. You know, I hate it when I'm right like that. And it was 9 years ago. And so we need to keep the pressure on them, but not at the price of driving them away. And because they are a singular asset. And, you know, as we look at the competition with China as it stretches out before us, what is really important is our ability to shape the international environment in a way that advances our national interests. Mm-hmm. Allies are an important asset in being able to shape that environment.
And it's interesting what you pointed out, how many politicians today, and really many Americans out there, look at NATO as this relic of the Cold War and say, look, it's just an albatross around our neck. Or rather amazingly, there are many people, including the president, who say that the U.S. should consider withdrawing from the World Health Organization in the middle of a pandemic. How do we get Americans to take an expanded view of what the U.S. national interest is?
Well, it requires, above all, leadership from the president. Mm-hmm. There really isn't anybody else who can play that kind of a role. And that means and as much as presidents hate it, it means dealing more with Congress. It means more private meetings with members of Congress to say, you know, here's what we're trying to accomplish, and we would appreciate your help. And both Republicans and Democrats, because these members of Congress go back out into their districts, they have town halls, and they can talk about these things. And if the president has taken them into his confidence, or at least has tried to educate them and help them understand, that's one way of reaching the American people and helping them understand why it's important. Another, again, that nearly all presidents hate is the media. And the importance of using the media in order to explain what we're trying to do and bring some perspective and understanding that will help the American people understand why we're doing what we're doing. But as I point out in the book, you know, the truth is most Americans aren't very interested in international affairs, and they certainly aren't very interested in spending money overseas. And now, after 20 years of war, they're sure not interested in sending our troops over for anything other than a direct threat to the United States overseas. So it's up to the president. And this is not new. I think this is characteristically American. You know, just leave me alone. Let me go on with my daily life. And and let's just mind our own business and tend to our knitting here at home. And it's up to the president and our political leaders to help Americans understand that we can't isolate ourselves that way, that we are inextricably tied up with the rest of the world in every conceivable way, not just economic. And if there was ever a reminder of how interconnected we all are, the coronavirus is a perfect example.
Yeah.
But so were the terrorist attacks that came out of Afghanistan. Who ever expected that the United States of America, for the first time since the War of 1812, would be attacked, the continental United States would be attacked out of Afghanistan, for heaven's sake. So people need to be reminded that we can't ignore the rest of the world because the rest of the world won't ignore us.
Yeah.
And we are, and it's just as true economically as, I mean, when you look at the amount of agricultural products that American Midwestern farmers are selling to China, tens of billions of dollars worth, that's just an illustration of how interconnected we are. But it's the responsibility and the duty of our political leaders mm-hmm. to explain that to the American people. And they may not be enthusiastic about it, but if they understand it, at least they'll go along mm-hmm. with it.
Well, in the time we have left, I want to spend some time talking about some of these specific geopolitical challenges that you discuss in your book. China has been very aggressive in developing a lot of those non-military instruments that we have failed to use in recent decades. In particular, the Belt and Road Initiative comes to mind. Should the U.S. have found a way to have a seat at the Belt and Road table? I mean, just because it's China's idea doesn't necessarily make it a bad idea. There might have even been ways that America could use it to its advantage to strengthen ties with China's neighbors.
Yes, I think we should have, and I think we had that opportunity. When the Chinese created the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, President Obama elected not to join it. All of our allies did. There are now more than 100 countries that are constituent members of that bank. And had we joined it, it seems to me, first of all, we would have had some say in which projects get approved for financing through that bank if we were a member. And second, there might have been opportunities we could have developed for American companies to participate in some of those projects. So I think we missed out on a couple of different opportunities. So I think that was a big Obama mistake. I think President Trump's mistake was in walking away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which now those 11 countries have decided to go ahead on their own without the United States. And now the Chinese are talking to them about the Chinese joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But this would have been one of those places that I talked about earlier where we had all our allies on our side of the table to deal with the Chinese with a common agenda. So I think that we've missed a bet in, you know, and it goes to the larger question. You mentioned the World Health Organization. There's no question that these organizations are being exploited by China. But the answer to the way you deal with it is not to pick up your football and go home because you don't like the way the game was being played or being called. It's to get in there and try and fix them and restore your own influence and for us to restore our influence. Because the second we walk away, the Chinese step into the vacuum. Mm-hmm. They fill the positions we would have filled. They take their influence dramatically increases. And it goes back to my point. How do you use all the different instruments available to you to shape the international environment in a way that is favorable to your interests? Well, when we walk away from these institutions, we lose one of those instruments and we hand the Chinese the same kind of influence we could have had. So that's why I think it's a mistake to just, you know, turn our backs on these institutions rather than getting in there. But, you know, the truth is fixing them requires a lot of time, a lot of energy and hard work. And maybe we're just not up for that.
And you also addressed the North Korea question in your book. You say that Trump was right to reach out to Kim Jong-un, but the reality is that Kim has no intention of giving up his nuclear weapons. If that's the case, do you think that we've been too distracted by this fantasy of denuclearization to the extent that maybe it's kept us from trying to make progress on more realistic goals with North Korea?
One of the reasons that I supported the president's outreach to and willingness to meet with Kim Jong-un was, as I chronicle in the book, each of his three post-Cold War predecessors tried in various different ways to negotiate denuclearization with the North Koreans. And we did it bilaterally, we did it with China, we did it with other powers involved, the six powers, and none of it worked. None of it worked at all. And so it seemed to me it was worth trying something new. You know, some of the foreign policy hawks kind of gasped when he did that, but it seemed to me, why not? Nothing else has worked. Now, it hasn't worked out. And I think the reason it hasn't worked out is, as you suggested, I believe that the North has no intention of giving up all of its nuclear weapons ever. Kim Jong-un looks at Gaddafi, who gave up his nuclear weapons program in Libya. He's dead. His regime is gone. Saddam never had nuclear weapons. He's dead. His regime is gone. In 1994, the Ukrainians gave up 1,800 nuclear weapons in exchange for an agreement signed by the United States, the United Kingdom, and Russia, guaranteeing its territorial integrity. It's now lost half its country. So Kim Jong-un looks at these three situations, and why would he ever give up all of his nuclear weapons? It's the key to the survival of his regime, both, I think, realistically and in his own view. Mm-hmm. So my attitude is, if all of this has failed over a 25-year period, and the consequences of the status quo are that every year he has bigger and better and longer range missiles and more nuclear weapons, why would we not try and negotiate some kind of a deal that allows, that basically recognizes North Korea as a nuclear weapons power, which it is, and try to limit the number of those weapons to a very small number, and have the most intrusive inspections regime possible, anytime, any place kind of inspection, so we know they're not making new, more nuclear weapons, in exchange for lifting some or all of the economic sanctions. So I'm just trying to deal with the world as it is, not the world as we wished it would be.
Do you see a problem in the fact that the U.S. is now taking an inconsistent approach to aspiring nuclear powers like Iran and North Korea? We're tearing up the Iran nuclear deal while at the same time we're courting a deal with North Korea. Doesn't that send a mixed message?
Well, it certainly would add to the suspicion on the part of Kim Jong-un that any deal he did with the United States would be a questionable one. The funny thing is that always used to, that shoe always used to be on the other foot. We would always question whether another country with whom we signed a deal would adhere to it. You know, I think there were a lot of flaws in the agreement with Iran, and it really was an agreement that just bought time. It did not eliminate their nuclear weapons program. And it was essentially premised, as I argue in the book, on Obama's belief that in 10 years, Iran would be a different country, that there would be an evolution politically, and that Iran, by the time the agreement expired, would no longer want to have nuclear weapons. That was a huge bet. I believe it was a wrong bet. So I do agree that the agreement was flawed. But once we signed it, walking away from it was probably a mistake as well. We could have done more to limit their ballistic missile testing. We could have done more to resist they're meddling in the Middle East, basically to show them that the money they received from lifting the sanctions against them they couldn't use it to try and increase their influence or their meddling in the rest of the Middle East and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do any of those things. Right. We just took the agreement and let it go.
You also talk a lot about the role of the National Security Council, both in the past and looking forward, how their role might change. You've served on the National Security Council of four presidents, and I've heard you say that when the Department of State and the Department of Defense are at odds, which, let's be honest, they often are, that opens it up for the National Security Council to interfere. How did you manage that relationship, both when you were on the NSC and when you were Secretary of Defense?
When I was Deputy National Security Advisor under the first President Bush, first of all, we were very lucky in that We had a very strong and congenial team, as I write in the book. For most of my career, the Secretaries of State and Defense couldn't stand each other. And there was a time during the Reagan administration where Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Weinberger weren't even speaking to each other. The result is it really makes the process much more complicated. But in the first Bush administration, you had Jim Baker as Secretary of State, you had Dick Cheney as Secretary of Defense, and they really got along well. They were good friends. They would even go fishing together out in Wyoming. So the departments really worked in good harness, I think, during that time. That was not the case with the situation between the second Bush administration, between the Secretary of State Colin Powell, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld. I had a very different relationship both with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice under President Bush and Hillary Clinton under President Obama. And my attitude really was shaped by the fact that I didn't mind being in the background. Mm-hmm. My attitude was, when you're the Secretary of Defense, you never have to elbow your way to the table. You've got all the money, all the people, and all the weapons. Nothing can be done without the Secretary of Defense being right on board. And so, acknowledging the Secretary of State would be the principal spokesperson got rid of a lot of the friction. And the fact that I'd been friends with Condi Rice for 25 years before that, 20 years. So that was never going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. But with Hillary Clinton, I did the same thing that I did with Condi. And I said, I had lunch with her in the Defense Department before she ever took the office of secretary. And I said, look, people are going to try and set you and me against each other all the time. That's just the way bureaucracies are. So if one of your people comes in or one of my people comes in and tries to set my hair on fire because of something terrible you've done, supposedly done, I'll just give you a call and say, is this true? But with that person, with the provocateur sitting in front of me, and I know you will tell me, no, it's not true. And then I will turn to the provocateur and say, the next time you ever try and do that, you will find yourself in Thule, Greenland, on a permanent assignment.
Yeah.
So we really were able to get along pretty well. The NSC, the concern I had, especially in the Obama administration, was micromanagement, particularly the war in Afghanistan. At one point, I was visiting the Special Operations Command Center in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and I saw a direct line to the White House. And I stood there and I told the commander of that facility, tear the phone out while I was standing there. And I basically told all of our senior commanders, if you get a call from anybody at the White House other than the president, you tell them to go to hell and that I said so. And if they have a problem, just call me. And so I was able to push back against that micromanagement, but it really was a problem. Beginning with Iran-Contra and some other episodes, anytime you allow the National Security Council staff to end up with an operational role, you're asking for trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Gates, I know you have to go. So real quickly, staying on the subject of the NSC, Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, has come out with some pretty damning claims about the president recently, and Trump has in turn called him a liar and a traitor. Now, both you and Bolton served in the Reagan administration and both Bush administrations. Did you have much interaction with him? And what's your own assessment of his character? Would you use the words liar and traitor to describe John Bolton?
Well, first of all, our paths never crossed in the Reagan administration. I was still out of CIA, and
right.
and they hardly crossed at all during the Bush administration when he was ambassador at the UN. For reasons that I think are now clear, he often, unlike Obama and his UN ambassador, Susan Rice, who constantly came to the White House for NSC meetings and so on. I don't think Bolton was ever invited to the White House while I was Secretary of Defense to an NSC meeting, maybe once or twice. And so we really didn't have, we had almost no interaction at that point. And I think our paths have crossed once at a conference someplace in the last 8 or 9 years. I'm in no position to judge whether he is telling the truth or not. I think it is. I think it is fair to say he is self-interested.
Fair enough. Well, Dr. Gates, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And again, the book is called Exercise of Power: American Failures, Successes, and a New Path Forward in the Post-Cold War World. Robert Gates, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Robert Gates for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Exercise of Power: American Failures, Successes, and a New Path Forward in the Post-Cold War World, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.